Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. There's a line from the Bob Dylan song that goes, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Sometimes some things are so obvious that you don't need an expert to tell you that they're happening." My next guest is the weatherman, and the wind is the increasingly rapid change we see and feel and experience every day in the world around us. David Houle has been writing about the future and sounding the alarm about where he sees the wind blowing for more than a decade, and it seems to me we've gotten to the point where we really don't need a futurist to tell us that it's happening. Houle has been talking about a coming shift from the information age to what he calls the shift age, or perhaps it's already even happened. Houle is a guest lecturer and futurist in residence at the Ringling College of Art and Design in Sarasota. He's going to be presenting a series of lectures about his projections for the future beginning next Monday, January 22nd. We thought we'd bring him on the show to pick his brain and get a bit of a preview. David Houle, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I am a Stone Dylan fan, and I have to push back slightly. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows if you're paying attention to which way the wind's blowing, and most people don't, okay? When I wrote my first book, I said, "What do you think about the future?" And there were three answers. Oh, it's personal. It's about my plans, what I'm going to do with my life. Two, it's really horrible. I don't want to think about it. Or three, people don't think about it, which is the largest category. So people don't even know that there's a wind blowing. But the other phrase phrase I always use about Bob Dylan is, those not busy being born are busy dying. That's the more apropos phrase.
Well, fair enough, David Houle. You can join our conversation by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. You can find us on Twitter at WGCU. If you use the hashtag GCL, we can put you on the show with your comment or question. So back to what we were just talking about there with Bob Dylan, do you think more people are paying attention now than they were when you first started writing and being sort of a self-described futurist?
Yes, without question. When I started talking about, I've been fairly accurate in my forecasts, and like 8 years ago, I said that streaming would replace all other forms of distribution. What has happened is that the speed of change has accelerated to the point where it's environmental. So when the speed of change is environmental, that means everywhere in every aspect of your life, you're experiencing change. So people are so disoriented or disrupted that they are paying attention. My job is to try and help them find the right ways to pay attention, to anticipate it, and to give them context or concepts to better understand the changes that's affecting them.
When did you first self-identify as a futurist?
Well, I've been doing it all my life. People say, what made you become a futurist? Actually, for the last 12 years, I've been a full-time professional futurist. But I always did things that people said wouldn't work all my life. You know, I helped create and launch MTV. Oh, video music, never happened. CNN, 24-hour news channel, won't ever need it. In the 90s, online courses, oh, that'll never happen. So it took this idiot here into my late life to realize that my highest value to the world is to speak about the future.
So you published your book, Entering the Shift Age, in 2012. How much of it has come to fruition in the past 6 years, and are there any parts of it that you feel like maybe you missed the target a little bit?
Well, when I do give that book out, and I give it out a lot, I say the good news and the bad news is you can see how right I was and how wrong I was. I would say that on balance, I was almost entirely right. If I were to rewrite that book, I would there's some gaps that I had. I didn't expand on what is commonly called artificial intelligence and machine learning as much as I should have. I mean, that's a primary focus for the last 3 years now. I probably would have emphasized a little bit more on AR and VR, though I did forecast that they would be huge. So all in all, I'm fairly comfortable with what I forecast back then.
So how do you define the shift age, most succinctly?
Sure. It's the age that follows the information age. Basically, I'm a student of Alvin Toffler, and he talks about ages. So there's the agricultural age, lasted 10,000 years, the industrial age, 300 years, the information age, probably 45 years, came into being in the 70s. And in 2005, I looked back and I realized that since the information age got its name, six things had happened. End of the Cold War, global economy, personal computing, the internet, wireless connectivity, and analog to digital. So I realized that just those five things, all huge each and of themselves, meant that a new age would come in. So then I thought about what the new age would be, and I realized the reason I called it the shift age was that, and it's loosely time congruent to the first third of the 21st century, was that this is the age that we're going to shift from the realities that we have known them throughout history to new realities that we're going to start experiencing, certainly full force by the late 2030s. So the shift age is really the transition between realities we have known it and reality as we will be experiencing it.
So you say this all started happening in 2005, 2006 or so. The smartphone as we know it became a thing that next year with the release of the iPhone in 2007. How do you see those two things connected, or if at all?
Well, three things. One, the iPhone introduced this to touch interface. Before that, it was keyboard. You know, the BlackBerry, right? People who are keyboard addicted still have their BlackBerrys. Touch is what Jobs invented with the iPhone. Number two, that's one of the few things I missed in my forecast. I knew that cell phones would become handheld devices and computers doing all kinds of functions. I missed the whole concept of the app. And the third thing I would say is that the iPhone really didn't hugely take off until wireless connectivity. I mean, if you're old enough to remember, there really wasn't, you know, 3G was a really big deal, and that was somewhere around 2010, 2011, and there was 4G. It wasn't until we got to high speed that the touchscreen phones took off, because that means you could watch video real time. It wouldn't keep buffering. So the iPhone and all the devices that followed it have taken advantage of the high-speed connectivity.
So you mentioned in passing when you talked about the BlackBerry that people are quote-unquote addicted to it. Is there a danger for addiction to something like a smartphone?
Sure, people are addicted, but I don't, you know, but people are addicted to driving, people are addicted to TV, people are addicted to whatever. I always say that, one, technology is morally neutral. It's not good or bad. It's how people use it. The invention of flight meant that distances got shortened, but also planes could drop bombs. So I think that the smartphone is one of the single greatest technological inventions in human history. When people get addicted to it, it's much more addicted about their social media. I'm not on Facebook. I find it a waste of time relative to other things. I mean, I have 150 books on my iPhone 6 Plus. I watch movies. I read all my periodicals. So it's how you use technology. There is an addiction issue, but I think it's more an addiction issue, which is why I think Facebook has got an existential crisis on its hands right now.
I'm joined by David Houle. He's a futurist in residence at the Ringling College of Art and Design in Sarasota. He'll be presenting a series of lectures there beginning next Monday, January 22nd. You can join our conversation by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. We chatted the other day a bit before the show, and you talked about social media, you talked about Facebook, and you said something that I thought was really interesting that I'd like you to explore now, which is how social media has created sort of a blur between intention and action. Can you explain what that's all about?
Yeah. From a philosophical moral point of view, that's where I have a problem with it. In other words, prior to the concept of likes and follows, people had a good intention, but the question was, are they going to act on the good intention? So there was a clear void between intention and action. And so this whole concept of likes, I think a large percentage of the people on Facebook think that making a like is taking an action. And it's not. No one's ever been able to answer my question, how many likes does it take to get a cup of coffee, right? So it's a non-existent thing. That's one thing. So it is allowing people to think they're active, or they think they're supporting a cause, or they think they're helping a friend, but they're not. It's not an action. The second thing is the the bifurcation of experience. Whenever you travel to a beautiful place or an art museum or something like that, people are always taking pictures. You know, they're taking selfies. In other words, people will see, say, the Mona Lisa, and the first thing they want to do is take a picture of it. So they can't stand and fully experience the beauty of a painting. They got to document it. I've seen people that go on trips, and they're so busy sharing what they're taking pictures of, they're not fully present. So one, creates the false illusion of an action, and two, it bifurcates experience into it's not completed as an experience until I share it.
You know, you talked about with social media and technology in particular, you said technology is not good or bad. It's sort of morally neutral. Now, access to information, though, is there maybe a point at which there's too much information available to us? I mean, we only have so much attention to pay. And if the way content is being funded is based on attention, like, you know, it is our attention to something that makes it viable as a product on the internet. Is there somehow in there like a recipe for disaster where the people trying to get our attention are extending our ability to pay attention beyond what we're capable of? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, it makes sense. I don't fully agree with what you're saying, and I understand the question. The information explosion is ahead of us. All the information that was created in the year 2004 was the first year it was equal to all the information created in human history before that. So now we're doubling all the data created by humans about every month. So it's only increasing because of the Internet of Things. So there's no such thing as too much information. It's like saying there's too much knowledge or, you know. So, but what I say is that people have to take responsibility. You can't just get over it. You got to decide what you like and stick with it. I mean, the way I get lots of incoming in my, you know, couple hundred emails every day just on data and newsletters and stuff like that. I don't necessarily read it all, but I have to do it as a futurist. What people should do is decide who they trust. I mean, a lot of information is best perceived as an aggregation. So I have somebody I trust in technology who aggregates the news I should read in environmental issues. In technology, it's just medical issues. And so I read the aggregator, so I'm not constantly surfing. You get lost on the Internet. So it's a matter of testing people who you trust. I mean, I trust half a dozen periodicals that I read religiously, but also people who are really good aggregators in certain topics.
You know, you were around before all this information and this technology, just like I was. And so you maybe had an ability to see that you needed to use aggregators and you needed to somehow rein in all the things that are coming to you. Now, with digital natives, which is a term that you talk about and it's a term I've heard elsewhere as well, you know, the kids that are growing up never having had an analog world, never having had a world without instant access to everything. And if you go back to this idea that the marketers of the Internet are trying to gain their attention, is there a danger that they might not be – unless we teach them to be mindful, that some kids might get sucked in into a point that's not healthy for them.
Absolutely, unquestionably, I couldn't agree more. I've often been asked by parents how to better parent their children in a wide open media environment, and I say two things. I say one, help them figure out who they are, their sense of self. And have a conversation about how that self should relate to the world. And then the second thing is just tell them that if they come across something that doesn't make them feel good, leave it. I mean, you know, if they come across some pornography or some violent stuff, just leave it. But you have to teach them a moral compass and a sense of self. If people are very ADD or don't have a sense of self, in other words, all their stimuli, all their gratification, all their happiness is externally, not internally, they will have more problems than people who have a strong sense of who they are.
Where does artificial intelligence fit into your theories? You mentioned that you kind of wished you had maybe dug into it more deeply when you wrote your book, 6 years ago. But where does it fit into your theories now? Do you sort of fear our coming robot overlords or not?
First of all, there's nothing to fear about the future. I mean, fear is an emotion experienced in advance. And people shouldn't live in fear. They should live in fear of, you know, something that's threatening them if somebody's walking down the street with a gun. But you shouldn't fear the future. Artificial intelligence we spoke of briefly before. I was really getting upset about this whole stupid conversation about, oh, Terminator 3, robotic overlords. Technology is morally neutral. And so I got frustrated, and I looked up the word intelligence, and nowhere in there was the word human. In other words, dolphins are intelligent, whales are intelligent, people listening think their pets are intelligent, right? So the word artificial is inappropriate. It's intelligence. The reason I think we call it artificial intelligence is because we are the first, people listening right now, are the first iteration of humanity to have to psychologically accept an equal or superior intelligence cohabiting the planet with us. I would say very simply, the easiest way to think of artificial intelligence, I call it machine learning, is that it's the single greatest technological invention since electricity in terms of how much it's going to change our lives. So, for example, what electricity did, it allowed us to be active through the night. It allowed us to air condition the desert. It allowed us to have appliances in the kitchen. It allowed us to plug into computers. It allowed us to have long-distance electronic communications. None of those things were thought about when electricity first got invented because we couldn't think about it, right? Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is we're thinking about artificial intelligence from a non-artificial intelligence landscape, going, oh, it's going to get rid of jobs. Oh, it's going to run out of overlords. But we can't think about the possibility that maybe by 2050, most people won't have to really work for a living, right? I mean, how great would it be? I've had many conversations where I've asked people in the audience, raise your hand if you always love your job. And very few people raise their hands. So we may have an opportunity, I mean, I would say that electricity was something that allowed humans to evolve beyond the restrictions of daylight and beyond the restrictions of place, because electricity created space, connection, everything. Artificial intelligence, what is called artificial intelligence, I call it the age of intelligence. I think the next 20 years will be the age of intelligence, the age of climate change, and the beginning of a post-capitalist society. The age of intelligence, think about the fact that quantum computing is being madly researched now, and that quantum computers, so the scientists say, will operate at 100,000 times faster than current computers today. So that what may take a current computer 6 months of simulation could be done in a matter of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I mean, it staggers the mind. So the only reason to be fearful of the future is if you want nothing to change. And the problem with that is the only constant in the universe is change. So the best way to adapt is be open to change.
All right, we only have a couple minutes left, and I'm going to ask you a really big question and ask you to give a fairly short answer. You talk in your book about how the shift age also represents or will be defined by a sort of fundamental shift in consciousness on a very real level. Can you flesh that out briefly for us?
Yes. If you're a baby boomer, as I am, you grew up with a sense of place. You had to go 1,500 miles to see grandma. I grew up in Chicago, so I rooted for the White Sox. You know, blah, blah, blah. But your children or anybody who's got a child that's under the age of 17, say, or 18, has grown up in a spatial context. In other words, grandma's just two keystrokes away. Grandma, all I got to do is push, video conferencing. I can see grandma. So the children today have a spatial context. You know, they have friends on Facebook on the other side of the planet. I didn't have access to that. You, I think, are a little younger, but you didn't have access to that. We had pen pals, right?
Right.
So we've moved from a place-based consciousness to a space-based consciousness. And I also think, if you think about it, we're moving from a human computer interface that goes from touch to voice, I think, to brainwave. So within the next 10 years, there will something come to market where as you develop your brains, our capacity to concentrate, we'll be able to run our computers by thought. That's a different level of consciousness. And if we do that for 10 or 15 years interacting with computers, would we not be able to take the next step and do it directly with each other?
Well, I'm going to have to leave it on that because we are out of time, but I want to thank my guest. David Houle is a futurist, or is the futurist in residence at the Ringling College of Art and Design up in Sarasota. He'll be presenting a series of lectures there beginning next Monday, January 22nd. You can learn more about them on our website, wgcunews.org. Just click Gulf Coast Live. Mr. Houle, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it and enjoy our conversation.
Well, Mike, thank you so much, and thank you for reading the book. I really appreciate it, and have a great day.
You too. Our show today was produced by Rachel Iacovone and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live was made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kinnairy. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM. We are NPR for Southwest Florida. Good afternoon.
Never seen it quite so clear. When my heart is breaking, I can close my eyes. It's already here. Cause it's gonna be the future soon. I won't always be this way. When the things that make me weak and strange get engineered away. It's gonna be the future soon. Never seen it quite so clear. When my heart is breaking, I can close my eyes. It's already